Test. This is Dave Crippen of the Archives and Records Center of the Henry Ford Museum. And today we're in St. Augustine, Florida. And this is February 4th, 1985, on one of our design history interviews. And today we're speaking to the well-known designer, Eugene T. Gregory. Mr. Gregory is known to his legion of friends and admirers as Bob. And we're going to ask Mr. Gregory to... by the way, Gregory is spelled G-R-E-G-O-R-I-E. And we're going to ask Mr. Gregory to tell his story in his own narrative in a chronological fashion.
Speaking of the spelling of the name Gregory, that comes from the Scotch, my Scotch heritage. And one of my ancestors, James Gregory, was a professor in the University of Glasgow, and he is credited with being the inventor, the creator of the reflective telescope. So that I have always had mechanical leanings, interested in things mechanical and whatnot, so that it naturally followed. My mother was quite an accomplished artist, very capable, accomplished, imaginative woman. Mm-hmm. And my father was he was always interested in steam engines, and you might say pretty much like old Mr. Ford. He could name a steam engine, and he could tell what steam engine it was by the sound of it. Mm-hmm. He's always interested in locomotives and things of that sort. And I've always been interested. We my brother and I were born and raised on the coast, and we at a very early age took to boats before we could even swim. Oh. And down on the south shore of Long Island, we spent all of our spare time when we could, and even sometime we should have been in school, fooling around with boats. In other words, we might refer to, as they do on the Chesapeake Bay, as water boys. They refer to the men there as watermen. Mm-hmm. I guess we might have referred to as water boys. Well, so when I had an opportunity, I'd always been around yachts and boats and sailing and whatnot. So before I went to several private schools, and in the course of that, I never really finished school. I somewhere about what would have been the equivalent of ready for college, I decided to go to work. And I went to work for the Elko Works in Bayonne, New Jersey, which is part of the Electrodynamic Company, which in turn was a submarine boat corporation, as a marine draftsman. So I took up yacht design.
Had you had any training for this in high school?
No. I just went to work for Elko under a very capable man, the head designer there, Bill Fleming, and I'd always been interested in yachts, so it was a natural for me. I just fell right into it. I just moved right along. Mm-hmm. And following that, I went to work for the distance where I had to go from where I lived on Long Island over to New Jersey was too much every day. So I, after a year, year and a half, I couldn't do it any longer. So I was able to make connections in New York with Cox and Stevens, one of the top naval architectural concerns in New York, which ultimately became Gibbs and Cox, same corporation. And there, I was able to work with some very renowned marine designers, and I like to think of the man's name. Funny, I can't reach back. Yeah.
Cavanaugh.
Yeah, cut it. I'll think of it, because it was very excellent training.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can this continue? I mean,
yes.
I'll just let me have one in particular. Chiefus? Very fine foundation for marine design, naval architecture, particularly as far as yachts are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And after several years of that work, my father had always been interested in unusual automobiles. Now we can knit this thing together.
Mm-hmm.
We had at home about that time, we had an old 1910 chain drive Mercedes.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was one of the, might refer to as an early car nut.
Mm-hmm.
He loved foreign cars, and we had French Delage and Amel car. I had a French Amel car.
Mm-hmm.
And that led into my interest in automotive activities. And as much as I love the naval architecture activity, I could see a much wider scope for my interest in cars.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was quite an engineer. He understood engines and the lubrication of them and the structure of them. And so I had a very fine foundation, appreciation for fine automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
So the next step that I took was to give up the quit the job at Cox and Stevens designing yachts. In the meantime, I'd sketched up some very interesting body designs and went over to see Rolls-Royce Brewster.
Oh, yeah.
In Long Island City.
Mm-hmm.
And Brewster at that time built the American Rolls-Royce. They were affiliated,
mm-hmm.
building it in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And this would have been in the summer of 1929,
mm-hmm.
and spring of 1929, and I was there about a year. And so that sent the message to me that was the field I wanted to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And in the fall of 1929, I took off for Detroit.
Forgive me, what did you do for Brewster? What sort of work did you do?
Automobile body sketches and drawings.
Sketches.
And yeah.
They were a custom body house.
Custom body. Brewster built custom bodies for most of the high-priced chassis.
Mm-hmm.
And they at one time built a car, a Brewster car, a little four-cylinder,
yes.
Very, very beautiful
and
little car.
And you were to team up with them a little bit a few years later at Ford, were you? Briefly.
Well, in a way, a very interesting connection.
But let's get to that. We'll get that.
Well, I took off for Detroit
uh-huh.
in the fall of 1929, about two or three weeks before the crash came.
Uh-huh.
And when I arrived in Detroit, well, of course, on the way to Detroit, I stopped to see several of the automobile manufacturers along the route.
Which one?
The family having owned Franklin cars,
mm.
I stopped in Syracuse. And talk with the managing director there and whatnot, and of course they were in a bad way, and they were about to throw in the sponge, as they say.
Yes.
And while I was in Syracuse, this is an interesting little
mm-hmm. yes.
side bit. I'm trying to think of a man's name at Syracuse, the chief engineer. Well, anyway, he mentioned to me that Ray Dietrich had just been there. Was on his way back to Detroit, and he said, when you get to Detroit, why, you look up Ray, and maybe, you know, we work out something with you.
Now, what was Ray Dietrich doing at this time?
Ray Dietrich was building some special bodies, custom bodies, for Franklin.
Ah.
He'd come down from Detroit and spent a day or so at Franklin, and he said Ray was just here. This is about 10, 11 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over to the New York Central Depot to get a ticket to Buffalo. The family had also had Pierce Arrow cars, and I thought, well, I'll go there and tell my story, you know, and
mm-hmm.
so on and so forth. So when I got to the station, I was at the ticket window, and this man was standing in front of me with a portmanteau of,
yes.
of arch, you know, and And he said, do you have a reservation for Raymond Dietrich, Mr. Dietrich?
Incredible coincidence.
And I tapped him on the shoulder, and I said that I'd been over at Franklin Plant, and I don't recall his name immediately, but he was the man in charge, chief engineer there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'd like to, I'm on my way to Detroit, and I've been with Body Design, you know, with Brewster and so on and so forth. And of course, he, incidentally, had worked for Brewster as a boy, see?
Really?
Yeah. So we sat together in the parlor car as far as Buffalo, and he was going on to Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And can you shut that off a minute now? Just... Well, he welcomed me, and we had a very nice discussion
this
on the train.
Mr. Dietrich.
With Ray Dietrich on
right.
The train going up.
Mm-hmm.
And he pulled out his flask from his hip and ordered orange juice and proceeded to get feeling quite nice and friendly.
This is still prohibition, of course.
Yeah, oh yes. He offered me one, but I wasn't old enough to consider the value of it.
How old were you at that time?
21.
21.
A
21.
Very young man.
Yeah, 21. So I got off at Buffalo and spent the night there. And the next morning, I went over to the Pierce Arrow plant. And
was this the main plant?
Main plant, of course. That was the only one they had there. And met the man in charge. I'm sorry, I can't recall the names. I do have them written down. But oh, that's 50-some years ago.
Mm, yes.
So, of course, there was nothing there. They were about to fold up, too.
Mm, yes.
So I took the night boat, the old D&C boat, to Buffalo, to Detroit.
Yes.
You know, the next morning.
Yes.
The last run for the fall. I mean, it was getting toward winter. And
this is the Detroit and Cleveland line.
This is the old D&C.
Oh, I wasn't.
No, Detroit and Cleveland was different.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they ran to Cleveland. What they call the other one? They call the D&C lines.
Yeah, okay.
Haven't you remember, which is usually downtown?
No, but the Detroit, there's two lines.
That's
there
right.
was a Detroit and Cleveland.
You're right. Mm-hmm.
And the other one was a Buffalo to Detroit. But they were both known as the D&C line.
That's true. Right.
Yeah, they had the docks down on the waterfront in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, I arrived in Detroit my 21st birthday.
Oh.
Saturday morning, 21st birthday. Well, I had... inquired, Ray Dietrich asked me where I was going to stay in Detroit, and I said, well, would you know where a Horatio Alger type boy arriving would find lodgings with his straw suitcase, so to speak? And so he mentioned the Lewis Hotel up on Woodward Avenue. It was up close to the General Motors building, you know, just below Grand Boulevard. It was
mm-hmm.
a 4 or 5 story commercial type hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took the streetcar and Woodward Avenue streetcar. I couldn't understand what the conductor was talking about when he all that Midwestern
mm-hmm.
growl they have.
Yes, very flat. Yeah. Still
so,
there.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I took a room there, and Monday morning I went over to General Motors and presented my interest to them.
Credentials?
Yeah. And talked with a chap called Howard O'Leary.
Oh, yes.
Howard O'Leary was Holly Earl's front office man, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Weed him out or take him in, see?
Right. Right.
So Howard O'Leary hired me. As it was then, it was kind of a screening process. They'd hire any boy that could draw an automobile, I guess, in those
mm-hmm.
days.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I went to work for General Motors. So they...
Was this the Earl Trim and Color Department? Or
Art and Color, they called it then.
They called it what?
Art and Color.
Art
it was
color
in the General Motors building there,
right.
You know,
on
the Boulevard there.
Yes.
Yeah. And I worked there for, I guess, 3-4 weeks, something like that.
Now, what did they have you do?
Well, I was sketching cars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they give you...
So an internship?
Yeah, I suppose, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd had some experience with Brewster, you know, and I knew what it was all about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, the market crash came.
Oh.
And last in, last out.
Right.
First out, as they say.
I know what that means.
Well, anyway, there's a funny little connection with Ray Dietrich in connection with the Lewis Hotel.
That's right.
I'll inject it.
Yeah.
After I'd been there a week or so, the elevator boy, the colored boy that ran the elevator, I asked him if he knew Mr. Dietrich, and he referred the hotel to me and so on. He says, "Oh yes, I know Mr. Dietrich. Yeah, he come here about, you know, not too often, but he keep a nice place up way up on the top of the hotel there." He says,
uh-huh.
"Yeah, he said he go there and have a party every now and then, see?" And as it developed, well, he had a little girly friend that he bunked up there, and that was his little playhouse up there.
Mm-hmm.
And the colored boy, he let the cat out of the bags.
Ray was in your
double A. I told Ray that some years after that, you know, and he said, "That's so-and-so." He says, "What did he mean?" Tell me. This is 10 or 15, 20 years after that.
That's
well, anyway, things were tough in Detroit then.
Yeah.
I am, in the meantime...
Forgive me. Did you get to meet Mr. Earl at all in the
first
you were there?
Oh, yes. Yes,
can
yes.
you give us an impression of Mr. Earl?
He was a pompous man. He was a big man, 6'6" or something, and
mm-hmm.
he that was part of his style. And he was a
right
sporty
there.
Dresser, you know, from California, and,
mm-hmm.
and boom, 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 boom.
Yes.
And, of course, he was associated with the Fisher Brothers, and they were all playboys, and... In later years, I got to know them at the automobile shows down in Detroit, and I could see how this thing works, see? Well, anyway.
Was Bill Mitchell there, by the way?
No, he came there later, no.
Okay, good. But Howard O'Leary and...
And then Frank Hershey.
Oh, was Frank there?
Frank Hershey, yeah, I don't know if you know about him or
yes.
not.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, he was at General Motors when I worked there.
Yes.
And Frank had given up a nice room. In one of the big old mansions out on West Grand Boulevard, they'd been turned into rooming houses.
Right.
A nice old gentlemanly like gal and her daughter had this big place, and Frank was giving up the room there and taking an apartment with some other chap. So I moved up there, and in the meantime, I went back to Detroit, to New York.
Mm-hmm.
To Long Island to get my little French Citroen car. I had a little French 5-horsepower Citroen.
Uh-huh.
And this was early December, very cold, mean. So I went back one weekend, and I started back with it for Detroit, a little convertible. No heater, cold, mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I got up into Pennsylvania, a little town called Hawley. Broke a valve spring, went to a country garage. Talk about nerve, driving a thing like that out there in those days. You couldn't have gotten a part for that thing inside of Paris.
What company was it? You said Citroën?
Citroën, little Citroën.
C-I-T-R-O-N?
Little,
yeah. Oh, Citroën, yeah.
Citroën.
Oh,
it was their little bread and butter car, a little tiny 5-horsepower. It didn't have there was no starter, and didn't have a fan or a water pump, so a thermosiphon cooling.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a real adventure to drive that thing to Detroit in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, I got in upstate New York. Oh, wait a minute. I got to Hawley, Pennsylvania.
Right.
And I had a valve spring go out on it. And I went to a little country garage, and this old fellow took the valve spring out. It was all simple, you know. It only took a few minutes to get at the valve spring, a little cover play there.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Well," he says, "this looks like an inner valve spring on a 24 Buick." In those days, they had an inner and outer valve spring. See, this was a little tiny inner spring.
Mm-hmm.
So he got one out of a trash bin there he had and popped it in there, and he said, "By God," he says, "that'll work." So he put the valve spring in, and Lord, the whole thing was a half hour and $2, and I was on my way, see? Well, I did all right until I got up to a little place called Wayland, New York. It was about 40 miles below Rochester. And it had been snowing all day.
Mm.
And the snow had been laying in the fields, but hadn't been laying on the road. But along about 5 o'clock in the evening, unknowingly, it had turned to a glaze of ice.
Mm.
And this little bugger spun around 3 or 4 times in the middle of the road and went over in a cornfield, laid on its side.
Oh. No seatbelts in those days.
No, and it only had one door on one side. Fortunately, the side with the door was up. so I had sense enough to reach under and turn the gasoline off. You had a gasoline tank in the cowl, like a Model A Ford,
mm-hmm.
and I cut the gas off before it set fire to the
right.
thing.
Good.
And so I got out, crawled around, straightened myself up, and along came two farmers in a Model A Ford touring car. In the back, they had a big piece of rope, and we hooked the rope on and tipped it up right. The three of us tipped it up, pulled it up on the road, and they towed me into Wayland, about a mile into Wayland. We put the car in a little country garage there,
mm-hmm.
and I got a room for the night in a little farmhouse. An old gal had a little farmhouse down the road, so I bunked in there for two or three nights. In the morning after that, the snow was 4 feet deep up over the windows. So I was holed up there for three or four days with this little car, and I went to the country garage, and we put the rear wheel was bent, and we put it in a press and straightened the wheel out.
Mm-hmm.
And 4 or 5 days, I was really tied up there 5 days. And then I went on finally to Detroit. It took me 3 days to go. It took me about 8 days, 8 or 10 days to get from New York to Detroit.
Incredible.
It was so cold going across Canada. In this little convertible, I had to take newspaper and cork the window frames up. There was no heat, and every now and then I could stop at a country store and get a cup of hot tea. They always had hot tea.
Mm, yeah.
And I'd stand there, warm my feet, you know. And
mm-hmm.
I finally got to Detroit, and things were rough there. There was no work anywhere.
Mm.
And as it happened,
this is the winter.
Winter of 29 and 30.
Yeah.
And I went down to Cadillac Square, and Cox and Stevens, the naval architect concern, had an office in the Balaam Tower, on the 30th floor of the Balaum Tower.
Okay. B-A-R-L-U-M.
That's right, and they used to have the old Balaam Hotel, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up to see my old acquaintance, Bill Furman, was there. He was one of the top naval architects. It used to be Hacker and Furman.
Mm-hmm.
He used to build a Hacker speedboats and all that, you know. And,
yeah.
and Bill Furman was so glad to see me. I had met him on some of his visits to the New York office. And at that time, they were finishing up some big yachts up in DeBose, a shipyard in Bay City. Leftovers from the boom and the contractors and whatnot. Well, anyway, he had one particular yacht that he wanted me to work on, do some drafting work and layouts and so on. It was a 126-foot yacht called Rosewill, and it was being built for Bill Rands, W.C. Rands, who was one of the founders of Motor Products Company.
R-E-N-D-S.
Yep, R-E-N-D-S, and he had offices, private offices, over the National Bank Building.
Oh, yeah.
And I worked there on the plans for that yacht. We went until midsummer of 1930. And
he hadn't canceled the order?
No. Mr. Rands had sold out his interest in motor products, and he was rolling in it.
Ah.
And he'd take me out in his big Cadillac with 4-inch carpets in the back, and he'd take his shoes off and rub his feet in those thick carpets. He's a funny little roly-poly man with pince-nez glasses.
Oh, really?
he would come up to the office up on the 30th floor, and we were drawing profiles of the yacht.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Furman, we'd want to make a change on it, you know, to improve the profile, change a port light location or something of that kind.
Mm-hmm.
And old man Rands would lay down his little fat pot belly on the floor and had a cushion under his chin, and he'd look at that the profile, and he said, "You boys have put something over on me. You put something over on me. You've changed something. I don't know what it is, but tell me now. Tell me now. What is it?" And Bill would wink at me, and I'd wink at Bill Freeman. Well, anyway, that kept me going, you know, and we finished that work up about mid-June, and I took off. In the meantime, I contacted Ford Engineering Laboratory out in Dearborn.
Yes.
During that spring, and
spring of 1930.
That's right. And the Lincoln body engineer was Henry Crecelius.
Yes.
C-R-E-C-I-E-L-U-S. It was a German name, but I couldn't.
C-R-E-C-U.
Crecelius. C-E-L-I-U-S. C-E-L-I-U-S.
That's correct.
Crecelius. Have you run across his name and all that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, anyway,
he was the chief body engineer.
Chief body engineer, and Edsel Ford had brought him from Brewster.
Ah, that's Had you known him at Brewster?
No, I had known him at Brewster. That was previous to my connection at Brewster, was just a year or so early in that. And I spoke with Mr. Casillas, and he was very sympathetic in my plight and so on, and I told him it wasn't a question of eating beans or anything like that. I had a very fine home in Long Island. I could go back any time and be comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to stretch it out in Detroit as long as I could. I knew I had a future there.
Mm-hmm.
So we made had a nice conversation and so on, and he appreciated the fact that I hadn't been with Brewster. Well, I went on back to home in Long Island and fooled around with boats that summer and skippered a good-sized yacht for a wealthy friend of mine. So that was that. Well, that fall I went south with the family down the plantation in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And the day before New Year's, I received a telegram from Henry Casillas to come to work at Ford's.
At
Dearborn, at the laboratory at Dearborn, yeah.
Yes.
And I had to catch a 2 a.m. milk train coming through on the Atlantic coastline, and it was so cold, I went up in the signal tower at the embassy at the crossing of the CNWC and the Atlantic coastline. They crossed
mm-hmm.
there.
Right.
So I went up in the signal tower and kept warm with a little coal stove the man had up there
mm-hmm.
until the train came through.
Mm-hmm.
Then I arrived in Charleston the next morning, and caught the. I took a Clyde liner. We were able to get steamers in those days,
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Left at 1 o'clock. New Year's Eve, I was out off Hatteras, rougher than hell, and I got to New York Monday morning amidst ice floes.
Oh.
And a gal on the boat was reading tea leaves that night. And she told me, I can see a small man, dark-haired man, and I can see a long, low, white building in your future.
You've never told this to me before.
Haven't I?
No, sir.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
And
a long, low, white building.
Yeah. Of course, I didn't give it a thought, you know.
Mm-hmm. Had you been out there yet? When you talked to Mr. Casillas earlier on? Was he at the Lincoln plant down?
No, he was at the engineering laboratory.
Laboratory.
Yeah,
Durbin,
and that's where I saw him. But I didn't make the connection.
Sure.
It didn't mean
okay.
a thing to me.
Right, yeah.
Well, the small man was, of course, Edsel Ford, and he said he's going to be an important part of your future.
Incredible.
And it wasn't until years later that came back to me. Damnest thing, reading tea leaves, see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just, you know, passing the time. Well, that's a fact.
It sounds like tarot cards.
Well, I don't know what the hell it was, but anyway, that's a fact.
Incredible.
And
you're not a believer in that sort of thing.
Huh?
I say, and you're not a believer in
no,
that.
Not at all. Excuse me a minute.
You could repeat.
Yeah, I said, I subsequently arrived in Dearborn to report to work for Mr. Casillas. It would have been perhaps 4 or 5 days after New Year's, 1931.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And my work there involved design sketches for Lincoln cars, Lincoln bodies, custom type bodies, and so on.
Can you give us a sort of a bird's eye view of how what the department was?
It was a very small group. Mr. Casillas and two or three body draftsmen and several detailers.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was on a very small scale.
In other words, you didn't have a design department like
no,
GM,
no,
did
no, no, no way, no.
Styling
no.
department.
No. You see, Lincoln at that time, as I recall, they were just going into production. Or developing the bodies for a standard line of Lincoln bodies, sedan and close couple sedan on two wheel bases. No, the cars were on the shorter wheel base. The Lincoln at that time was both 136 and 145 inch wheel base, and the shorter wheel base was utilized for the standard bodies, the factory made bodies.
Mm-hmm.
The longer wheel base car was fitted with custom-built bodies by 10 or 12 custom bodybuilders who were in production at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Dietrich, Willoughby,
Brunn.
Yes.
There were 8 or 10 others.
LeBaron?
No, they didn't get into too much. LeBaron LeBaron did build a roadster body for the Lincoln, the big Lincoln. But
not for the small
Waterhouse and and
Locke.
There were some Locke bodies. It was practiced then for Mr. Ford to select from design sketches brought to Detroit by the various builders.
This is Mr. Edsel.
Edsel Ford. He would select maybe 10 or 12, perhaps 15 bodies from each builder. The bodies were usually finished, what they referred to as finished body in the white, which meant that they were unfinished. There was no paint, perhaps a prime coat, but no trim.
This would come from
come from the various bodybuilders like Judkins in Merrimack, Massachusetts, and Brunn in Buffalo, and so on and so forth,
right.
And Willoughby in Utica.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the bodies would come in, and then they would be trimmed and painted and fitted with custom moldings and so on as per the customer's request.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so that actually most of the design work at that time was done by the body builders.
Mm-hmm.
And now let me inject this, that when the body builders brought the sketches in to present them a showing for Mr. Ford, he would no doubt make critical comments as to what he liked and if the molding was too wide, or he was an excellent critic.
Mm, yes.
Mr. Ford was in no way a designer, but he was a critic.
It's all right, honey, don't worry.
He
about
could
it.
Control design by
don't
being
that.
A critic.
Don't worry about it.
And people have frequently asked me, and many people have written articles on the subject to the effect that Mr. Ford would bring in sketches and things like that.
Yes.
I personally had never seen a sketch that Mr. Ford had made.
Mm-hmm.
He might have made sketches at home. He was not a designer. I've never seen a design that he ever created, but they tell me he did make sketches at home, which no doubt he did. Well, anyway, I'd never seen one.
Mm-hmm.
But he was an excellent critic, and he understood what I was talking about, and I understood what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So that is why it was a two-man team, and he was not one to be pushed into someone else's idea.
Mm-hmm.
And going back, way back in history, as far as Ford design is concerned,
mm-hmm.
the Model T, from the Model T on, the cars, the early Model A's and whatnot, the first Model A's, the 28, 29 Model A's, were for really a miniature Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
That was
right.
What they leaned on, the placement of the headlamps, the fender shapes, the radiator contour, and the whole thing was a scaled-down, large, old 8-cylinder Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe Galamb, the old Hungarian...
G-A-L-A-M-B.
Yeah, old Joe Galamb. They called him Shit the Metal. Shit the Metal. You make this out of Shit the Metal, see? Shit the Metal. Well, anyway... he started out with Henry Ford pretty much way back in, God, when I was a baby,
mm-hmm.
1908 or 10, along in there, see?
Mm-hmm.
And old Joe was a clever put-togetherer.
Mm-hmm.
And, but he's an arrogant little man, you know, a very pompous little man. He looked like a little foreign diplomat. He was perfumed and he wore fashionable clothes and mm-hmm. very nice-looking little guy, a little gray mustache. And I'll never forget. Aside from the progress of what we're talking about,
yes.
I'll never forget, Mr. Ford came up to me one morning outside of my office at the engineering laboratory, and he said, "Have you seen Joe around? Seen Joe around?"
Is this the elder Mr. Ford?
The old gentleman.
Henry Ford.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, in the meantime, Joe walked up, and he said, "Good morning, Mr. Ford. Good morning, Mr. Ford." He's sort of like a head waiter, you know, in a fashionable restaurant. He'd always bow to Mr. Ford.
A maitre d', yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Mr. Ford turned around and said, "Joe, what the hell's wrong with you? I've had you around here for 30-some years, and you still can't speak English. What the hell's wrong with you?" "Yes, Mr. Ford. Yes, Mr. Ford. Yes, Mr. Ford." Well, that's one of the few, good-natured incidences that I can remember Mr. Ford being involved in. I mean, he was a very...
yeah, but they
what's the term?
around.
I don't like to say sour.
Contentious.
Yes, yeah. He never displayed much sense of humor.
Right.
Only where it fitted his particular feelings of the occasion, see.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Another incident, we had a Mr. Davis there who was the patent attorney. His office was next to mine. Mr. Davis was quite a lush. Mm. And Mr. Ford did tolerate some of those people if they served his purpose. His head furniture buyer, I forget his name now, big burly guy, good natured, and he'd send him off on these trips to Massachusetts. And
Gregory?
No, he's a real estate man.
Yeah, he's real estate.
Here's the real estate man.
Newton.
Right. Charlie Newton.
Charlie Newton, right.
Yeah. Great big red-faced guy. They'd send men out to sober him up sometime. Well, anyway, as much as Mr. Ford disliked liquor, he would tolerate certain people. Oh, look at Bill Cameron.
Of course.
Yeah. Wow.
William J. Cameron.
What a lush. He could swim in it.
The horses never came down the pike.
Well, anyway, Mr. Ford came and asked him, I'd seen Davis, you know, next to my office. And I said, no, Mr. Ford, I haven't seen him so far this morning. He said, too much.
Is this Jack Davis you're talking about?
No. This is Davis, the patent attorney.
Oh, I see. And
Jack's another story.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. Oh boy.
Mm. Well, let's see, where were we?
You're in Dearborn, and it's spring of 1931.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, anyway, I went along sketching cars and, you know, small incidental activities.
I'm interested, Mr. Gregory, in...
Bob Gregory.
Bob, thank you, Bob. Yeah. I'm interested in establishing the feeling or the of the fledgling design department in those days. How did it work?
They didn't have any design department.
It wasn't there.
No. Well, that's what I was coming to.
Fine, thank you.
In connection with these outside suppliers.
Mm, yes.
Briggs and Murray were the big suppliers of Ford bodies.
Right.
And
they were in Detroit.
They were in Detroit, and of course the Lincoln design was supplied pretty much by the custom body people.
Right.
And in those days, the chassis engineering designed the grill, the hood, and the fenders, the front fenders.
Good.
Yeah. And that brings up another cute little story. Hmm. Okay. Want to eat now?
Anytime.
This was the elder Mr.
Yes. When they bought the Lincoln Motor Company in 1922, I think it was for $8 million.
Right.
It accomplished several purposes. It gave the boy something to do.
The boy.
As they referred to, as Charlie Sorensen and several of his henchmen, the top upper echelon of Henry Ford's production group.
Mm-hmm.
Give the boy something to play with, see?
Mm-hmm.
And it fitted in perfectly because he was interested in custom bodies and the possibility of being associated with that sort of thing in a high-quality automobile.
Mm-hmm.
So they bought the Lincoln Motor Company. That got them off, it got Edsel Ford off their back to a certain extent because they'd gone about as far as they could from a styling standpoint with the Model T. And that was his particular purpose, Edsel Ford's particular purpose was to expand a better taste in the Ford product.
Mm-hmm.
A higher plane taste, if I can put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and as I mentioned to Edsel Ford when I first had an opportunity to know him, one of the detriments in trying to sell the Lincoln car and service it was the fact in those days most of the service came from a Ford garage.
Mm-hmm.
I said, can you imagine a man paying $5,000 or $6,000, which was a big custom price in those days, going into a car, traveling cross country, into a Ford garage with an old dump truck or a garbage truck parked next to him and say, this is a service on my Lincoln? And he got the biggest kick out of that. But I could see those things. Sure. I could sense those things. They clicked him. They clicked, mm-hmm. clicked. See?
Yeah.
And but I'd bring those things up. Now Joe Galland would never think of that, see.
Did they finally establish a separate network for
Lincoln? Oh, sure. Well, they had Lincoln agents in big cities. I mean, mm-hmm. Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But in the urban areas, they didn't have them.
Right.
And it didn't lend any prestige to owning a Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
It was a kind of a drag down, see?
Right.
And I pointed that out. But I have a knack of bringing these things up as tactfully as I could, but I always fortunate to bring them up with the right timing. Mm-hmm. I can mention one or two little cute incidents where Edsel Ford, one of the few times we had little cross words together, was when, right after the Mercury was introduced at the New York Automobile Show. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, Mr. Ford had insisted on the car being called the Ford Mercury. Mm-hmm. Ford Mercury. Hubcaps, mm-hmm. battery, window glass, stenciled, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't read right to me, because we were trying to sell the car to a bracket above the Ford.
Right.
That's why the DeSoto was created. That's why the Pontiac was created.
You were plugging the gap between the Lincoln
That's
and the
Ford. Right. We're spanning that gap.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gotten charts out showing the price, the big spread,
mm-hmm.
with charts which I still have.
Mm.
And I said, Mr. Ford, I have second thoughts about, you know, the about having the name Mercury, Ford on the car.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean? What's wrong with the name Ford? 39 years we built the name Ford up. Isn't that good enough for this automobile?
Edsel speaking?
Yeah.
Oh,
boy, this is about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I said, boy, here I go. Woo. Mm. So, well, anyway, I said, look, that's my thought on it, and I don't know how you feel about it. Well, anyway, the following week, down at the automobile show, see? Oh my God, the sales managers and the branch managers, they climbed all over Mr. Ford. He was down there. We went down, came back on the same train on the Detroit. And in the meantime, I had my boys get together racks of hubcaps, you know, without the Ford name on it, see?
Yeah.
And I told Mr. Ford, I said, you know, you turn the ignition on this car and it sounds like a Ford, the exhaust sounds like it, the whole thing. And not only that, but the competition to say, get down and look under the car. That isn't a Ford. Radius rods, buggy springs, you know,
mm-hmm.
boom, boom, see?
Mm-hmm.
So I met him getting off the Detroit that morning about 8 o'clock, and we come back from the New York Automobile Show, and he said, Bob, some stuff, I asked him how he liked the show. He said, fine, there's some things we have to go over. He said, I'll be in right after lunch. So I had the boys get all the racks ready and so on, and so it was never a word said after that. We just shifted over to the Mercury hubcap, and they got the Ford name off, but that was the only time I've ever seen him flare up at me.
The only time.
Yeah.
He was a real gentleman, wasn't he?
Oh, terrific. My God.
Bob, really.
What a man. What a man. We had some of the greatest.
The rapport was beautiful.
Yeah, that's right. If I wanted to build a special built car of some kind, I'd always have to contribute something to the possibility of it being a production item or something that would contribute to the development work.
Right.
And he kind of winked and he said, well, maybe we can arrange that. He said, I'll see the powers that be. I'll see the powers that be. He said, I'll see you next week.
Mm-hmm.
So
he and Bob had the most beautiful association, really.
Yeah.
This is a shame that man had to die so young.
Yeah.
And such a delightful person.
Well, I began to feel a great responsibility because he depended on me to such an extent. I could see that he wanted to pull away from dependence on these body people.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't care for the flamboyance of John Jotter and some of these hot shots. John was a whore master and a playboy, and he all patent leather hair and all that, and squared shouldered suits, and that's before I didn't go for that.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't care to make a decision in large company. He didn't care to discuss anything with a group standing around him. He didn't care for conferences, anything of that kind.
Mm-hmm.
He loved to come in and sit on the end of a drawing board and have me pick up an old blueprint and sketch something on the back of it, a hood ornament or some damn thing. He said, all right, sis, let's do it that way, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Does it look good to you? Okay.
Which is where the Lincoln Continental came from.
Yeah.
Basically that's simple. Down to it.
Yeah.
And is my fire all right,
honey? Beautiful. I really didn't realize what had taken place until after the thing was underway.
This is the Model A.
Yeah, Model Y. Yeah.
1932.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the development was in 1932 for a 1933-34 series of Fords.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was the background? Why was the model needed?
Well, I redesigned the small Dagenham Ford. It was a horrible, boxy-looking thing. Very practical, I guess.
Yes.
And it was very popular over there. And when Edsel Ford, this was his decision. I didn't really have anything to do with his desire to take this small English Ford that I designed. And I didn't know this was taking place, really. I didn't have anything to do with that. He just said, look, take this car and step it up, see, mm-hmm. to Briggs and whoever the suppliers were. And Kramer, the body draftsman, the body engineering department, the Ford company, handled the whole.
Mm-hmm.
They stepped it up a certain percentage, whatever it was, you know.
What were they stepping it up from?
From the little English Ford.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so that supplied that took care of the design needs of the 33 and 34. The only difference between the 33 and 34, the bottom of the radiator grille on the 33 swept outwards. The 34 was perfectly straight.
Mm-hmm.
The 33 had curved louvers on the side of the hood panel. The 34, they were straight.
Mm.
That's the only difference of the car, see?
Mm-hmm.
And I incidentally acquired a 34 Roadster. They were pretty little cars. And
this is
I had
Model Y.
No, not the Model Y. The 34 basic Ford production.
Oh, you're talking about the basic domestic Ford.
Domestic Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the boys down at the aircraft plant fix one up for me. It was really a beautiful thing. I had the special windshield and the special top, and I had some beautiful aluminum disc wheels turned for it. And those are some of the little favors, or what do you call them? Perks.
Perquisites, yes.
Yeah. And so far, I didn't mind my perks. That was one way he could compensate me for the very minuscule salary in those days.
Imagine, yes.
Yeah. But it was a very nice arrangement. I mean, I enjoyed it. But where were we in this? Right after that, Mr. Ford came to me and wanted a special body built on one of the first 32 V8 chassis.
Mm-hmm.
And I drew up a little boat tail speedster.
Oh, yes.
With cycle fenders, pretty little thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we had it built over at the Lincoln plant, partially in the engineering laboratory and over at the Lincoln plant.
This is Mr. Ford's personal car.
Edsel Ford.
Edsel Ford's personal car.
Yeah, that's right. Beautiful gunmetal gray leather upholstery and so on. And he kept that out at his estate.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what would have happened with the little car. It's a very pretty little car. Have you seen pictures of it?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Would you want to touch on that ham, honey?
Shortly after that, Lord Perry came over,
mm-hmm.
one of his frequent visits.
Mm-hmm.
From Dagenham,
mm-hmm.
and Mr. Ford asked me to see what I could do with that car that was being built over there. So I redesigned it and so on. So
the Dagenham Ford.
Dagenham Ford. Mm-hmm. I guess you call it the Y.
The Y.
Y model. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
The late horsepower, 8 and 10. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody was happy about that, and everything went along smooth, and that became the 33 and 34 Ford.
Yeah. Can you describe in some detail, although you did just momentarily ago, the actual details?
Well, it was an engineering change, an engineering change. They just simply stepped the car up with a proportional divider, so to speak, and
mm-hmm.
I forget what the percentage was, but they mm-hmm. stepped it up, and I think it was on 112-inch wheelbase somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize it until after the thing had gotten going that's the order that Edsel Ford had given to do this. He didn't talk to me about it particularly. He was very pleased with the car, and
mm-hmm.
he came to me one day and said, "How you like it?" I said, "Fine." He said, "Do you recognize it?" I said, "Yeah."
Who do you think might have given him that order?
Given who?
Edsel.
Oh, well, that was his order.
His own?
Oh, okay, sure. Fine. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he handled all body work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The funny thing was, occasionally, old Mr. Ford, the old gentleman I referred to him, I mm-hmm. think that's a nice reverent term.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I'll say that with a wink.
Yes.
He'd come in to my laboratory, or design mm-hmm. department, as I say,
mm-hmm.
and he'd look around, and I'd just start to describe something to him, you know, and this and that, what's going on, so on.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd throw up his hands, and he'd say, "Oh, that's between you and Edsel. That's between you and Edsel."
That's between you and Edsel, see? That's all he'd say.
Mm-hmm.
He'd walk out.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, he was frustrated by styling and design. He had no interest in that at all.
Hmm.
And that's the reason Edsel Ford must have been awfully frustrated that his father would not take any interest in that phase of the automobile.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Ford had established himself as a mechanical genius, so
mm-hmm.
to speak.
Yes.
He didn't have any room for anything but the mechanics, the nuts and bolts.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
And Edsel Ford, on the other hand, I think the old gentleman had a feeling that Edsel Ford was too artistic for the automobile business, if I can put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You follow me?
Yes.
He wasn't hard-boiled enough in the mechanical end of it.
Mm-hmm.
God knows he tried enough to get hydraulic brakes put on the car and a mm-hmm. suitable suspension system and other improvements which were far past incorporating in the product.
Yes.
And those are some of the things that I sensed. I was right there when a lot of these things took place, just a pantomime. I was mm-hmm. Observed the pantomime between the two of them, see?
Mm-hmm.
And little side remarks that between Edsel Ford and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And he would clue me far beyond the way he'd speak to other employees, and he knew that I sensed
yes.
his problem.
Mm-hmm.
I call it his problem, see?
Yes.
And so, getting back to the Lincoln, the acquisition of the Lincoln, it sort of got Edsel Ford off the old man's back as far as something to do or to express himself from a design standpoint. He had the wonderful platform with the Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he could build it for the types of friends he had. He had a feeling for that type of thing. He wanted to elevate himself,
mm-hmm.
taste-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Lincoln in the picture, it was a perfect thing for him. And also, I think that he had the feeling that a certain amount of that would dribble down into the Ford product and be acceptable to his father, see?
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard a discussion, a style discussion or appearance discussion between his father and himself. That I stayed absolutely clear of. I'm
mm-hmm.
sure there were many very interesting conversations took place.
Mm-hmm.
But I never did get in on them. And as a matter of fact, whenever he and his father had a discussion, usually, frequently, it took place in my quarters. And
mm-hmm.
I had always instructed the boys to stay well clear and
mm-hmm.
give them all the privacy they wanted. So
mm-hmm.
But they would spend perhaps an hour and a half in a corner of our place there, sitting on the edge of a drawing board and
mm-hmm.
talking over their personal situations, which
right.
is entirely private to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where a lot of the important company decisions are made, I presume.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But
basically, the relationship was affectionate, but often antagonistic.
Yes, yes.
Adversarial.
Yes. In other words, obviously, old Henry Ford had absolutely no interest in the design and appearance of the car. And a lot of the niceties that Edsel Ford wanted to build into the product, he felt was superfluous. He had a mania for simplicity. I mean, crude simplicity,
mm-hmm.
you can put it that way.
Yeah.
I remember talking to him one day. We were standing in the engineering laboratory, and he had his foot up on the side rail of a Model T chassis, and he pointed down to a cross shaft that ran across between the two side rails,
mm-hmm.
and it had a U indent in it,
mm-hmm.
that when you pull the emergency brake, it threw the car out of gear.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it was a little cam effect.
Mm-hmm.
He spoke to me, he pointed to it, and he said, "That's one of the cleverest things I've been put in an automobile. One of the cleverest things ever built into an automobile." And I agreed. I said, "Mr. Ford, that is a very, very unique development."
Mm-hmm.
Tongue in cheek. But you know, another time, he came into my office one morning about 9:30. I'm trying to think. This must have been after Edsel Ford's death. Between that, yes, it must have been a year or so after that.
Mm-hmm.
And he came in, he came up to me and said, "Let's take a ride." And I don't know what the hell he wants to go for a ride. But so we went out in the service garage in the back and got into one of the service cars, and I said, where'd you like to go, Mr. Ford? Pointed down, we went down the test track, down to the airport, you know, mm-hmm. where they had the test track.
Right.
He said, come on, let's go in. So we drove in the gate, and want to hold this a minute? Yep, shut this off a minute now. We're going in the gate of the test track. We drove on in, and I told Mr. Ford that inasmuch as they're running high-speed tests around the track, the brakes and skidding and various other things, that it was a requirement to check in so that they could flash the signal lights and that someone else was coming on the track.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a signal to me, and he took his two hands and put them as though he was going to sleep, you know, and that's all they do, they come on, he said, let's go on around there. So we're going in the wrong direction, see? He said, that's all right, let's go. So here we go down the test track. These cars are swerving this way and that way, and fortunately there was a grass strip off to the side, and someone had seen him in the car with me, and they passed the word very quickly, and they flashed on the danger lights, and all the traffic came to a standstill. In the meantime, these cars were running various high-speed tests and whatnot.
Mm.
So all he did was made the circuit around, and I didn't speak any more about it, but I didn't know what his thought was on it.
Mm-hmm.
But we went on back up to the lab, and that's all there was to it. I mean, he just wanted to take a ride around the test track, and we mm-hmm. could have been the victim of a horrible thing. It would have been the two of us who left.
Incredible.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They came that close, see? These cars were skidding all over the place around us. But that was just one of the weird little incidents that take place, you know, and around the Ford situation.
Well, we were back in 1932, and you just about...
We finished up that little two-seater Edsel Ford,
yes,
at the
right.
Lincoln plant.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And
was this the boat tail?
The little boat tail speedster.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, this was...
That was in the summer of 32 we built that.
And the boat tail was a result of both yours and Edsel Ford's love of... He was
amused by the fact that I drew up the sections of it like you draw the hull of a boat,
mm-hmm.
and developed the paneling for it and so on.
Right.
And when the car was finished, it wasn't finished until in the fall. I know the weather was cold. I drove it back from the Lincoln plant in the snow,
mm-hmm.
and but I never saw the car after that. He took it out to his house and he used to use it out there.
Mm-hmm.
But he made a acute remark at that time. It seems that that whole summer of 1932, the Lincoln plant was shut down, period.
Mm.
Just a maintenance crew there. And
sales were way down.
Robinson, Robbie, we used to call him, he was the manager of the plant. Robbie and I and two or three of the maintenance men there did most of the work on the car. And when the car was finished, why, Mr. Ford made the comment that it cost $25 to drive a nail there in the plant at that time. He said, you should see the bill I got for this car. He said, you wouldn't believe it. Of course, it was all Ford money. It didn't make any difference. You know, they had the people there.
Yeah.
But it came out as part of the overhead of the plant, see?
Mm-hmm.
some of those things were interesting when you stop to think of the amount of money that was available to spend and the way it was spent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he felt good about keeping that many people busy, really, see?
Mm-hmm. Right.
In his many words.
Sure.
Yeah.
He was always very solicitous of his employees.
Yes. I never heard Edsel Ford make a derogatory statement about an employee or a mean comment about anyone in any form.
Mm-hmm.
He could be annoyed, he could be aggravated, but he always handled it in a very gentlemanly fashion. He came in one day, talked with me, and he pulled a slip of paper out of his pocket. He said, what do you think of this? And it was a production curve.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened to be the beginning of pheasant season up there in Michigan. And that's like a religious holiday. Everybody from the factory goes pheasant hunting. There must have been thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, look what has happened to our production this last week because of the pheasant season, see? So he shoves it back in his pocket and he says, well, that's the way it is, see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But those are some little personal things that he used to talk to me about. I mean, mm-hmm. just in a casual way. It seemed to be a sort of relief to him.
And he'd like to transfer that information to me.
Right. Yes.
I don't know if he did it with other employees or not, but I always felt very satisfied that he would take me into his confidence about those little incidences that took place in the company.
Yes, yeah. Right, yes. So the Model Y is a success, and you've established your rapport with Mr. Edsel Ford by not only that, but by working on a personal boat tail speedster.
Yeah.
That he
then
liked.
Yes, then in 1934, the summer of 1934, he had given me the use of the Ford aircraft plant for any experimental work that we wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And
which is now vacant. So.
Yes, they had a skeleton crew there of sheet metal workers and 8 or 10 top mechanics and whatnot. Mm-hmm.
Right.
The reason they were kept on there was to provide service parts for the old Ford trimotor planes, of which mm-hmm. there were quite a number still
right.
in service.
Mm-hmm.
Manifolds and landing gear parts and things of that nature. And it provided a place for me to do some small-scale experimental work without interfering with regular Ford activities.
Mm-hmm.
And that summer, discussions about a Ford sports car came up again. Some sort of a... This, incidentally, is really the beginning of the Continental.
Mm-hmm.
For all intents and purposes, it could be
mm-hmm.
Classified that way.
Yes.
And I developed a sports car chassis
mm-hmm.
based on the 1934 Ford. And,
which was one of your more beautiful designs, there.
Yes, but it all that we used from the 34 Ford was the chassis rail, the chassis frame, and the power unit, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But I developed a special front end suspension, which enabled us to lower the car down 5 or 6 inches,
mm-hmm.
and also extend the wheelbase about 10 inches.
Mm-hmm.
And it involved an entirely different front end suspension, and also we lowered the rear end of it by cutting the frame off, the standard Ford frame off, just ahead of the kick up, and turning it upside down and welding it together,
mm-hmm.
which allowed the frame to go under the axle. It was underslung rear suspension,
mm-hmm.
and I built up a chassis based on that concept, which I road tested for a couple of months in the surrounding area. And I